This is Jacinta Parsons on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
It's a question you must have been asked at a trivia night. At some stage throughout your life, what is the world's earliest surviving novel? It seems like a little trick, that sentence. The answer might surprise you, as it did our next guest and many people who hadn't read this book until relatively recently. It's a novel that was written over 2,000 years ago by a young philosopher by the name of Apuleius. It's a book that so struck our next guest for its enormous empathy with a lowly donkey that he's worked on a new translation and would love us all to have a read of this. He's well known to you, Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, animal rights activist and philosopher Peter Singer, who has now authored, you ready? You know, though, 17 books. Does it feel like you've written 17?
Yes, it does, really.
But also co-authored another 24.
Well, co-authored or co-edited, which is a bit easier, I have to say. You know, I've got some anthologies of readings in bioethics or readings about animals. So that's easier than actually writing them. I can't claim to have written that many. But
sitting down and writing a book is a thing, isn't it? I mean, how long do you set aside for a task such as that?
Well, it varies and it depends on whether I've got other things to do. Like if I'm teaching as well, it's really hard to make progress. You know, a couple of years, I think, you normally would think of.
This one, as you said, is a little simpler in that it's a translation that you've worked on with Alan Finkelpool of a book. Apuleius is the name of the philosopher and writer of The Golden Ass. What a story. I was saying to you off air, I blushed reading this, Peter Singer. It's an incredibly raunchy, rollicking tale.
Yeah, I think it's all of that, and it's fun, and that's, you know, this is the, in a way, the most fun of all the 17 books that I've written or others that I've co-authored. I think this is really the most entertaining, and so I hope people will read it for that reason. It's an adventure story, as you say. It's got some sex in it. It's got a lot of shrewd observations of human nature in it.
It does.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to be holding something that is that old, that has foundations that we understand. The human condition is translatable over that many years.
That's right. There's certain elements of human nature that don't change despite all the changes in culture. They've continued down the ages. But the thing that first attracted me to this was the empathy for animals that it shows. And that's more surprising because if we think of Roman times, we think of the Colosseum, of, you know, the Christians being forced to battle it out with lions and of other animals, you know, that actually imported wild animals from all over the Roman Empire in order to, so the public could come to the Colosseum and see them fight. It's the ancestor of the bullfight, but a lot more brutal and many different animals. So we don't think of Romans having a lot of empathy for animals, and most of them didn't, I have to say, and you see that in the book too. But Apuleius clearly did. He says the character in the beginning of the novel says that he's descended from Plutarch, and Plutarch was a writer who wrote some essays that have come down to us about sympathy for animals and even about abstaining from animal flesh. So, you know, maybe there's a connection there that Apuleius was sympathetic to Plutarch's ideas and decided to write a novel that in some way put some of those ideas, not abstaining from flesh, but, you know, what is it like to be a donkey treated brutally and used, you know, as donkeys would be for carrying heavy loads, for turning millstones. What would it be like to be a donkey in that time?
What's interesting is that he writes just prior to Christian ideology that very firmly places a divide between the human and the animal. So he in some way precedes that thinking, and it's very much apart from that. The fact that the human can transform into a donkey and back again is something unique to that particular period.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that there isn't that idea that humans all have immortal souls and animals don't, and that makes the transformation more possible. Just to explain,
give away the, you know, the exciting part of the book?
Okay, but I think, well, as you said, there's somebody who is a man who is transformed into a donkey and gets transformed back at the end. Maybe I shouldn't have given
that bit away. You know he's going to, though.
Yeah, he's written the story, right?
Yeah, he couldn't have done it with a hoof.
Yeah, that's right. But But yes, and there's other things in the novel as well which show that the boundaries between humans and animals are more fluid, or not regarded as a huge gulf between us in the way that they're was during the Christian era.
And this is so vital for the work that you have been doing since the 70s around this. We've almost been given a permission for the treatment of animals because of that ideology that emerged later, in that they are not of the same value as human life.
That's right, yes. And we have this, also the idea that God gave us dominion over them, that is in the Old Testament. We have, as I say, the idea that we have an immortal soul and they don't, that we're made in the image of God and they're not. And none of this was part of the Roman ideas. They were much more assuming that animals and humans, they didn't care for them generally. They wanted to use them. But I don't think they thought that they were such radically different creatures as in the Christian times.
It's also interesting that he chose a donkey and not something more regal and easily understandably similar to that of the human. The lowly donkey, you know, is an interesting animal for him to become.
I think the fact that he chose a donkey shows that he really was trying to engender sympathy for all animals and not only for the noble animals. And that's something that I can relate to very much. When Animal Liberation was first published in a hardback in the UK edition, which we also had in Australia, the publishers, Jonathan Cape, put a rearing horse on the cover. And although I could see that that was attractive, it was not the point of the book. You know, the point of the book is
the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we treat horses not too badly. And, of course, there are a lot of cruelties in the racing industry and in other areas. But compared to the way we treat chickens or pigs, you know, basically the animals we eat and the animals we get milk or eggs from, we treat horses quite well. And the book doesn't really talk about cruelty to horses very much. It does talk about factory farming quite a lot. In a way, I think Apuleius did something similar to what I was doing. He was saying, look, we can have empathy even for a lowly donkey. So, you know, what does this say about all animals?
Talking about that release of Animal Liberation in 1975, the practices of farming animals at that particular period, it wasn't uncommon for, you know, the mistreatment of them very, very broadly and that industrial nature of farming. That's changed significantly, would you agree, between now and then?
It's changed. How significantly depends on what you're hoping for. So it's true that, you know, there have been codes of practice about the keeping of animals, that some practices like keeping breeding sows in individual stalls, too narrow for them even to turn around, let alone walk a single step. That seems to be on the way out. They're more commonly housed in groups, which is better. But they're still indoors all their lives. And most of the pigs who are reared for pork and ham and bacon are kept in factory farms indoors all their life. And I think that's still a very boring life for a highly intelligent animal. And, you know, we still have hens in cages, which actually, in some other countries and jurisdictions, we don't have, or certainly not the standard small cages that we use. They're illegal across the entire European Union now, and so they've made some progress there. But although definitely the public now buys more free-range eggs and more cage-free eggs, supermarkets are still selling caged eggs, which is, you know, pretty much as bad as it was. So, no, I'm not at all satisfied with the progress that we've made over the, you know, it's 45 years since I published Animal Liberation. I'd hoped that we...
Had you hoped?
Yeah, I really had hoped that we would make faster progress than we have.
Is empathy the ingredient that's evident in the golden ass that's still missing as the transformer into a society that will treat their animals with greater respect?
I think empathy for the animals that we eat or whose eggs and milk we use is still missing. We do have more empathy for animals in general, I think. We have more empathy for wild animals. We're very concerned about them. Obviously, we have empathy for cats and dogs, and we've already mentioned horses. But there seems to be that gulf between the animals that we think of as products to eat, and we allow them to be produced as if they were just machines turning grain into flesh or eggs or milk, and the other animals. So, yeah, that seems to me to be the big problem.
Does it concern you that while we have grown in our awareness of treatment and you see a far greater population of people really caring about the decisions that they make regarding the animals that they eat and farm, that we're disconnected from our environment perhaps more than back in 1975? Do you think that's going to continue to be an issue?
Certainly that's an issue. It's an issue because we're now more aware than I was in 1975 that we're affecting the whole climate of the planet, and that's disastrous. And so we have to do something about that quite urgently. We're also more disconnected, I suppose, because populations have grown. We're living in bigger cities, more urban environments. More forests have been cleared over that time. On the other hand, we are now concerned about preserving some areas of wilderness in national parks or other protected areas. So we're getting these little gems, if you like, that are preserved, but they become islands. And if they're islands in something that's been cleared, then it's difficult for our native animals to survive.
Peter Singer is our guest this afternoon. He's worked on the translation and edited The Golden Ass. Apuleius is the author from 2,000 years ago. There's a question here. Does Peter think that the golden ass could be a metaphor for slavery? Romans treated slaves like animals.
There's certainly a connection. And in fact, we do get accounts of slaves working alongside the ass in The Golden Ass. So particularly at one stage, the ass is bought by a miller, and his work is to turn this enormous millstone inside a building in a darkened place. And if he doesn't just constantly turn this for hours every day, he gets beaten. And the people beating him are slaves, but they're also suffering. And Apuleius clearly describes their suffering, how the air is bad for them, they're locked in all day, how they're emaciated, they've been branded on the head, probably they're convicts actually who've been made slaves. So you get this sense that the animals are slaves and the humans are slaves, and it's brutal and cruel for both of them. And I think it's not just that the golden ass is a metaphor for slavery, but it is seeing slavery taking place both with human slaves and with animal slaves.
It's interesting, Apuleius at the end of this rescues Fotis, both his captor, because we won't go into too much detail. Should I have even said that he rescues her?
We'll leave that there for the reader to discover.
I've ruined this book, Peter Singer.
I think there's still plenty of people you haven't mentioned, don't worry.
No, true. And there's a lot I haven't said about this book. And in fact, the pleasure is in the reading of it, regardless of plot knowledge. We mentioned that you have edited this and worked on a translation with Alan Finkelpool. Very cheeky of the two of you to rewrite or create an ending that was not originally there.
I don't want to give more away.
We're not going to say what you did.
Right. Yes, we had fun with this. There's no question that we had fun in producing this book. We pruned away some of the digressions that I thought might be one reason why it's less well known and less well read than it has been up to now. So we changed things, and it was probably tougher for Ellen as a very serious scholar of the ancient times and a professor of ancient history. It was probably harder for her to take liberties with the text than it was for me. For me, it was just good fun, and how can we make this more readable?
She had a job ahead of her because the translation of this text is a tricky one. She said in this book that Apuleius makes up words. The structure of language that she's translating into English is totally different to how we read. So the job is about the honouring of the original text but ensuring that a modern reader can understand it.
That's right. And the other interesting thing about it, it may be that he wrote rather differently because he wasn't from Italy, as a lot of the famous Roman writers that we know were. He is actually an African. He was born in what's now Algeria, and he presumably spoke non-Latin languages that he learnt there. And so maybe that inflects his writing in Latin and makes it a little distinctive. And Ellen has tried to retain some of that while still obviously making it readable English.
The Golden Ass is the book that we're speaking of, edited by Peter Singer and translated by Alan Finkelpearl. There's a lot of ethical questions upon us right now. Peter Singer, can we dance to the left of us for a moment and talk about this pandemic and the big situation that we find ourselves in with a country like India and our response to that in terms of allowing Australian citizens to return to Australia? What's your position?
So it is a real dilemma, and although I'm not in general a fan of the present government, I can understand why they want to be very careful about letting the virus and possibly a more contagious variant of the virus into Australia, because we've done extremely well, and you know we have 25 million Australians. We don't want to throw us all back into lockdown with economic damage, plus, of course, with who knows how many hundreds or thousands of casualties. So I kind of agree with the pause on people coming from India now, but I think what we ought to be doing very urgently is establishing quarantine facilities so that we can bring in these people who want to come and do so in a safe way. And it ought to be possible if you really mobilise, maybe use the army to do that, to bring people in, to expand Howard Springs or to put them somewhere else in remote regions where they can be safe and Australians can be safe as well.
It's quite a time for an ethicist, isn't it, as we look at very large logistic and human activities like vaccine rollout. What have you made of that across the country, across the world, I should say?
Well, I've looked at that in various countries. Of course, with us, we're a bit constrained by the limits on the numbers of vaccine we have. Other countries have been dealing with the question about who to vaccinate first. And I have written about that. I think it's right to vaccinate the healthcare workers, and in Australia's case, the quarantine workers, to give them priority. And then basically to go for older people, because even though you could argue that they have less to lose because they have fewer years to live, on the other hand, the risk that they're under is so much higher than it is with younger people that I think that's justified to give preference to people, you know, in certain age brackets and work your way down.
What have you made of the world from an ethical perspective? Do you think in 2021 we're faring fairly well in the decisions that we make broadly, or are we still subject to, you know, the things we always have as humans?
Well, the problem is that we are still subject to thinking of ourselves first, and the great moral failure with vaccines is that we have not been distributing enough of them to low-income countries that cannot afford to produce them or don't have the know-how to produce them themselves. And we need to be making the vaccines available to them, enabling countries like India to produce their own vaccines in large quantities, which India could do. So that's the problem, that we're in a way locked into this international intellectual patent system and systems of particular know-how as well that make it more difficult for other countries to produce and obtain vaccines to cover their populations.
Do you think the disruption of this will yield any change to the way that we run business?
I'm not sure. I hope that we'll actually travel less and use Zoom and similar
platforms.
Have
you enjoyed that?
Look, it saves a lot of energy and, you know, I mean, not only fossil fuel energy but personal energy as well, because travelling a lot is tiring.
You've been teaching via Zoom
in Princeton via Zoom. I've also been giving talks in Colombia. I've got one lined up for Istanbul tomorrow night. I'm doing one in the Philippines next week. You know, none of this would be possible if I had to actually do the travelling.
No, this virtual self is not a bad thing.
It's not bad, yeah.
Now, I've got a question for you. My 9-year-old in the back of the car last week, you're a consequentialist, correct?
Right, yeah.
All right. So he says to me, all right, Mum, someone intends to do something bad, but by the series of events, it ends up being a good outcome. Is that person responsible for their bad intentions or for the good outcome?
I think you are responsible for the bad intentions. Obviously, the act is good. It's good that it brought about the good outcome. But if we're judging the person doing it, the moral agent, then you should judge them by their intentions. And if they tried to hurt somebody, let's say, but somehow by hurting them, you know, they startled them and they jumped away and otherwise a truck would have run over them, then it's a good outcome. But as you couldn't foresee that was going to happen, I think you judge the people by what they thought they were doing, what they were intending to do.
Can I get your number for the next load of those questions, please? It's getting harder to answer them with these
children. It's great that you have children who are asking ethical questions. I think that's terrific that you're encouraging them to ask those questions.
We've got a great program on ABC called Short and Curly. I don't know if you've heard it, but it's philosophy for kids. And they're now, you know, opening up these sorts of ethical frameworks to think through problems. Do you think we need to be doing more of this in our schools?
I think philosophy is very good in schools at all levels, both in primary school and in secondary schools. We do have some philosophy now in secondary schools, but there are philosophy courses and texts prepared for children in primary schools, and I think it's great if the schools would use them. But, you know, it's also important that parents encourage their children to ask these questions and don't just, you know, when they're busy say, oh, you know, shut up or just because or something like that.
I said, I'm talking to Peter Singer in a couple of weeks. I'll get back to you. No, I actually gave him an answer around law and he said, don't talk to me about the law. I want to know.
Okay. So he's already got the distinction between what you legally ought to do and what ethically you ought to do. And they can come apart, of course.
I know, it's a wonderful time. You're getting a lot of fan mail coming through our text line this afternoon. So good to still have Peter's voice in the mix. I did Philosophy 101 with him at Monash Uni in 1979. Remember it well. Half hour done. The phylogenic, is that how we say it? Phylogenic?
Phylogenic, yes.
Scale, do we as sentient beings extend rights? Cabbages screaming. Got me thinking a lot, says Jendal Joanna.
No, cabbages don't scream. There's no evidence that cabbages scream. But it is a good question because, you know, I think we have areas of certainty like vertebrates and obviously also some invertebrates because if you've seen the octopus documentary.
We've just talked about that.
Okay. So they're invertebrates, but it's pretty clear that they've evolved sentience and ability to actually even think about things and work things out. But what about insects? Pretty hard to know, really, to what extent. And anyway, that's a huge category. Maybe some insects have some capacity to feel pain or suffer and others don't. So that's where things get very grey.
Before you go, Kafka and Metamorphosis. This is actually originally called Metamorphosis.
That's right, it was, yes.
Surely there's it's a less uplifting tale, the Kafka Metamorphosis.
Yeah.
But still, you know, there's definitely that human ability, you know, going into the world of an insect.
Of a beetle in
that
case,
Yeah,
well, it's interesting because the golden ass was read in more in earlier times. In fact, Shakespeare clearly read it. There was an English translation that came out in the 16th century.
Mm.
And Shakespeare read it and uses some lines from it even in some of his plays. And in the Midsummer Night's Dream, you might remember that Bottom gets turned into an ass.
Yes, I played that role in Year 12.
Oh, great! So that is that. You know, Ellen Finkelpearl believes that that was inspired by reading The Golden Ass.
How wonderful! Yes, it's a really fantastic read. I loved it. I did say I blushed a little, but it was good for me getting back into some rigorous texts like this one. The Golden Ass. Apuleius is our philosopher and writer from around 2,000 years ago. It's been edited by our guest this afternoon, Peter Singer, translated by Alan Finkelpearl. What a joy to have a chat with you.
Thank you. It's been lovely to talk.
You're in Melbourne. You should just come round, have a cuppa, have a chat every now and then.
Sure, I'd be delighted to do that.
Thank you, Peter Singer.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, you're with Jacinta Parsons.